This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. With just weeks to go before the first televised Republican presidential debate, more candidates from that party's crowded field have been making the rounds here in New Hampshire. One of them was Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, who's positioning himself as the big ideas candidate, especially on health care. Jindal spoke with NH1 News.
I certainly think this needs to be an election on substance. I'm the only candidate that's got a detailed plan on how do you get rid of Obamacare. Every Republican will talk about it, but it's just a one-liner in their speech.
Also in the state was former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina, who bills herself as a political outsider and a fan of smaller, leaner government. Fiorina made her presidential pitch at events along the seacoast.
We have come to a place now, realistically, where the potential of this nation is being crushed by the weight and the ineptitude and the complexity and the power of the federal government of this nation.
Meanwhile, in state politics, no movement yet in the budget standoff, but Governor Hassan did sign a capital budget this week, along with a bill banning synthetic drugs commonly known as spice.
If a synthetic drug is on a shelf in a local convenience store that your parents go to regularly, it must seem to kids that that's just okay. And we want to make sure that they understand what the dangers of these synthetic substances are.
In the Queen City of Manchester, a policy change at the police department. Chief Nick Willard says he's revisited the prohibition on tattoos for police officer recruits.
It was becoming evident to us that military veterans were increasingly being excluded from our process because many of them have tattoos that memorialize their service.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent with the Associated Press. Rick, good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary, thank you for being here.
Good to be here, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and gentlemen, let's start with the gun bill that Governor Hassan vetoed. These bills often raise controversy. This one certainly did. Gary Reno, this concerned the rules around concealed carry. So how do the laws work right now? Who can carry a gun in a concealed way, in a coat pocket or a purse or a backpack?
Well, I think we have to say that, first off, anyone can carry a anyone can carry a weapon openly. But you need a permit these days under these laws to carry a concealed weapon. And that permit is given through the local law enforcement usually. And we've been trying for the last 3 years or 4 years in the legislature to do away with this law, to make it much more – make New Hampshire like Vermont, which doesn't have any such law. And just this week, Maine did the same thing. But this is the first time it's been successful getting to the governor. And – it got there largely along partisan lines. And what doesn't really repeal the permit, it repeals the requirement of the permit. Because a lot of gun owners want to keep the permit because of the reciprocity with other states. So that if you have a permit in New Hampshire, you can go to another state and use that permit. You don't have to go get another permit. So there's been a lot of pressure, been a lot of petitions signed and everything. On the governor not to veto the bill. But as she said earlier, she said she was inclined to veto it, and veto it she did this week.
Well, and what was her rationale, Rick, for vetoing this bill?
it's a purely a safety consideration for the governor and for those who oppose removing that second step, that second permitted step. You know, they think that police need to know when they go to a house, is this guy, you know, could he be carrying a gun under a coat or in a backpack or something like that? The supporters of the law worried that of the removing that permit, they thought police bias could get in the way because there's no hard and fast rule or you know some sort of metric to measure when someone can have a concealed carry permit. If a police officer knows that you know Joe Smith gets into bar fights every Friday night, he might not be willing to offer to issue that concealed carry license. And so that was sort of the rationale for.
Well, yeah, and that's interesting. And let's talk about that, Dean. Rick's right. Supporters of this change said the current system could discriminate against certain people. Some of them said the current system had the potential to be racist, sexist, discriminatory against poor people. The idea that police get to decide who's suitable.
Yeah, the argument – Rick's right. The argument was that the among gun owners that there's an element of subjectivity that doesn't need to be there in deciding who gets these concealed carry permits. And Governor Hassan essentially said, you know, the current system hasn't been working for many, many years. There's no reason to tinker with it. And Gary is right. This issue typically divides fairly closely down along partisan lines. It has in all kinds of contexts around the country and nationally in the debate in Congress over gun control in the wake of the shootings in Connecticut. When you talk to gun owners, you know, the reason why some want concealed carry is, you know, yes, you can carry a gun in public openly. But a lot of people don't want to walk around with a gun in a thigh holster or on their hip in the public because it makes a lot of people nervous or it can lead to the police being called unintentionally. So they argue they should have a right to just kind of keep this away and for their personal security. Supporters of the doing away with the permit call this constitutional carry. They view this as a constitutional right. And it's part of a much larger debate. And the pro-gun rights forces have typically been very strong on this issue, but you know we have a Democratic governor, and so I was not at all surprised to see a Democratic governor veto this. That's what you'd expect him or her to do.
Rick,
the gun issue, Gary, you mentioned it's been around for a number of years, and Dean just mentioned the pro-gun lobby and the anti-gun lobbies. This isn't going away anytime soon. There was supposed to be a rally this Saturday. It ended up being pushed off by gun rights supporters. Governor Hassan has already put out fundraising letters and emails to supporters saying, hey, the NRA and the gun lobby is going to come after me for this, so we need to be prepared to fight back.
It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. We're catching up on some of the big New Hampshire news stories of the week. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Gentlemen, just a sampling of the opinion on this on our Facebook page. Adam says the governor was not right to do this. He says, with the way the law is now, open carry being legal, I don't see any substantial reason to make it illegal to conceal carry. Veronica said criminals do not obtain guns legally or apply for permits. And Gregory said, great move, Governor Hassan, stand up to the NRA and gun crazy people. So thank you for those Facebook comments. You can give us a call, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Well, in contrast, gentlemen, to the concealed carry bill, where these gun bills are often controversial, Rick Stevens, a very uncontroversial bill was signed by the governor this week, banning what are called synthetic drugs. What are these, Rick?
Synthetic drugs. This is, you could see it on the counter at a convenience store or gas station. Spice is the one that everyone mentions. It's not designed to be a drug, but people have co-opted its use. It's a synthetic marijuana, essentially, or cannabinoid, as they call it. It's created some problems. Last summer in Manchester, some 40 people had very adverse reactions to this drug after they smoked it. I believe they smoked it. So what the legislation does is ban it from being sold in the state. And you can lose your license to sell liquor or lottery tickets. You can face a $500 daily fine. It's not insignificant, the penalties that the state attached to this new bill. And this is, again, sort of goes hand in glove with efforts that the state has taken to address the wide spectrum of drug abuse and growing drug abuse problem, not only here in New Hampshire, but nationwide.
Yeah, Gary.
Well, the very interesting thing about this bill and this banning of synthetic drugs is it's got a whole list of chemicals that supposedly are illegal. And it's a very interesting kind of thing because these chemists, the minute something is It's made illegal. They find another one. So, I mean, it's like a constant attempt to keep one step ahead of these people and to keep making these illegal
So to ban
substances.
It, the ban is harder than it sounds.
It's not as simple as it sounds.
But wow. This bill is intended to have in place procedures for continually updating the list of ingredients in order to kind of stay on top of it. And, you know, the issue against this was that it's kind of deceptive. You see these harmless little packets of this stuff in convenience stores, but it's actually stronger than organic marijuana. It's got a lot of chemicals in it that are potentially dangerous. So the biggest issue was grappling with the ingredient list and how to kind of keep updating that so you can stay one step ahead of the people who are producing it. And, you know, we had a number of different cities and towns moving to ban it. Now this is sort of a systematic statewide ban.
All right. Well, again, the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And, gentlemen, Tom's joining us from Henniker. Hi, Tom. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call today.
Sure.
My comment is about the governor's veto of the concealed carry law. And, you know, being a law-abiding citizen, having been a police officer, a sheriff, worked in corrections, I myself don't feel very comfortable walking around with a gun out in the public. I could, for instance, put a gun on my holster, walk into a bank to do business, or walk into the grocery store, and an awful lot of people are going to get very upset and probably call the cops, rightfully so. So what I think is some common sense is needed in this issue. You know, if I can legally carry a gun out in the open, but I put a sweater on or I put a jacket on and I cover it, then I become a criminal. So I don't see any common sense in vetoing that, and that is my comment. And thank you very much for taking the call today.
Well, Tom, thank you very much. Now, Gary, people can get a permit for concealed carry.
Oh,
Governor
yeah.
Hassan didn't say nobody can conceal carry.
It doesn't do away with the permit. It does away with the requirement that you get the permit. No, so, I mean, in Tom's case, if he's an ex-police officer, an ex-county sheriff, whatever, I mean, he's not going to have any problem getting a permit. I mean, there are the few instances and there are the few police, chiefs of police who made it, maybe took a little longer than people liked and things like that. But most people, I think you'll find that most people have no problem doing that. And to be honest, I mean, if you look at the polling on it, most people really think it's not such a great idea to open it right up.
All right. Well, coming up, thank you, Tom, again for that call. Coming up, we will catch up on the latest on the state budget. There's not a lot to catch up on there, instead of a lot of back and forth between the political parties. So we'll talk about that. We'll also find out about the big mental health lawsuit that was settled a year ago. A new report says progress has been slow. We'll hear from NHPR's Jack Rodolico on that. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More Friday New Hampshire News Roundup in a moment. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top stories of the week, and we're going to turn now to the state's mental health lawsuit settlement that happened a year ago. It was a big deal. With us now for a few moments is Jack Rodolico, NHPR's health and science reporter. And Jack covered this story this week. A new report, Jack, out about how the settlement and how the process around it is going. Just give us a quick background, though, to this story, what this was all about, Jack, please.
Sure. So in 2012, the New Hampshire Disability Rights Center sued the state of New Hampshire for essentially violating the civil rights of people with mental illness, saying that individuals were being forced into institutional care, whether that was hospitals and sometimes, you know, in other situations in prison, because there wasn't enough support for them in the communities. They weren't getting enough clinical help, emergency help, all kinds of things like that. And to sort of add a little weight to that, the Federal Department of Justice jumped on as a plaintiff. And so the state settled and essentially said, okay, we're going to spend $30 million over the next 4 years in a good faith effort to build up services. And so that was the goal as of a year ago, and we're about a year into that settlement. Now, so this report is from a court-appointed monitor.
That's typical, right, Jack, when these settlements, where you appoint a monitor to make sure things are progressing.
I would assume so, yeah. I'm not too familiar with big settlements like this, but this one I'm somewhat familiar with. So, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? So the court-appointed reporter is now studying this and talking to people throughout the state and trying to figure out, are we owning up to what we said we promised? And so on first blush, this report looks glass half empty because essentially what it says is we're behind schedule. On nearly every count, we're behind schedule. And that is physically building up the infrastructure of care around the state, you know, supportive housing, supportive employment, emergency services, access to clinicians. We're just behind the ball on all of these things. At the same time, though, that's somewhat expected because this is a huge change to how things work in the state. So when I talked to Commissioner Tumpas and even the Disability Rights Center, who, you know, they sued the state, they didn't seem too worried about the fact that we're a little bit behind schedule. So, you know, these reports are going to come out just about every 6 months. So in another 6 months, we'll get another report card and see how we're doing.
What were some of the benchmarks, Jack, that they were particularly looking at? You addressed a couple.
Well, so, you know, one of the interesting things that the state is struggling with right now is just collecting the data. I mean, this is a pretty dry topic, but just trying to get the information about how many people are getting care. Are they getting appropriate care? Do they have equal access to care depending on where they are in the state? And, you know, that's the biggest hurdle for the state next is for the Department of Health and Human Services just collecting information from people all over the state to say, okay, we know exactly how many people are getting care and it's had this outcome for them. And one of the more interesting, you know, figures I saw in that report is that, you know, the state runs its own psychiatric hospital. And one of the big problems is that people, you know, if you have an emergency, a mental health emergency, you wind up in an emergency room and then you get stuck in that emergency room sometimes for days waiting to get an inpatient bed at the psych hospital. And so what we're finding is that something like 1 in 6 patients that leave New Hampshire Hospital are back in New Hampshire Hospital within a few months. That's a lot. And so if we build up these community services, those people are less likely to wind up in the state hospital, and we're all probably going to be paying a little bit less for that care.
All right. Well, Jack Rodolico, we're going to be talking to you next week on a whole show on this mental health settlement, so we'll let you go for now. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
NHPR's Jack Rodolico, our health and science reporter. Again, he's been talking about the state's mental health settlement. The number for you to join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. I'm here with Rick Stevens with the Associated Press, Gary Reno with the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, let's catch up on all those presidential candidates who were here over this past week. 4th of July parades, cookouts, interviews, roaming the Granite State. By the way, Exchange listeners, if you caught any presidential visits, of course, we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Dean, I know you were hot on the trail of a couple of these folks. Mm-hmm. Who'd you see this week?
Yeah, it was a busy week. As you mentioned, a lot of candidates in town for retail politics. Merrimack and Amherst parades both had a lot of candidates marching in them and other parades as well. I had a chance to interview Dr. Ben Carson, retired neurosurgeon who's running for the Republican nomination, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, also running for the Republican nomination, and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who is running for the Democratic nomination. Three very different types of candidates, all in the firm belief that they are best suited to be the next president of the United States.
So give it to us again. Jindal,
Carson, Jindal, and O'Malley.
And O'Malley. Okay, yep. So Bobby Jindal, yep. Rick Stevens, did a couple interviews this week. We played a little clip from him on NH1 earlier in the hour. Give us sort of the where Bobby Jindal fits into this whole presidential field.
Jindal, the Louisiana governor, he kind of paints himself as I think the phrase we used earlier was the big idea guy, and this, he's going to think his way through this as a president rather than just be brash and bold and knock things over. He talks about he's the only one to have a clear idea of how to repeal and replace Obamacare, which we just had the big Supreme Court ruling a couple of weeks ago on that one. So that's sort of a tall order now. He hit a lot of the same themes that have arisen with some pretty high volume in the last 2 weeks. Immigration being at the top of the list, he weighed in on that. He struck that familiar chord that the rest of the Republican Party has, and I think all of the candidates on both sides. First, we have to secure the border. That's it. That's what you heard from all these guys all week was secure the border, secure the border. And then there are various ways to take care of the 11 million people who are in this country currently without legal status. So that's where Jindal is. He kind of fits more to the – a little to the right of center. I think that's an accurate portrayal of where he is in the spectrum of this Republican class.
Well, and since you mentioned immigration, Rick, I did want to ask you, Dean, what's the dynamic around immigration in this Republican field?
Yeah, well, it's really being driven by Donald Trump's comments when he announced his candidacy, and he talked about Mexicans coming across the border illegally and bringing crime, and some were rapists, et cetera. And then he sort of at the end threw in that some were probably good people as well. And it really has spurred this big discussion among Republicans. Some candidates have been more critical of him than others. Some, like Ted Cruz, have actually applauded him. We had that really tragic shooting of a young woman in San Francisco by a man who had been deported 5 times. Trump has kind of used that to sort of bolster his position. So it's been interesting. It really kind of unintentionally fired up the immigration debate in a very uncomfortable way for a lot of Republicans.
Well, and here is former Florida governor and Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush speaking in Hudson, New Hampshire, responding to recent comments made by, as you said, Dean, fellow candidate Donald Trump about Mexican immigrants.
You can love the Mexican culture. You can love your Mexican-American wife and also believe that we need to control the border. This is a bizarre kind of idea that somehow you can have an affection for people in a different country and not think the rule of law should apply. This is ludicrous.
What do you think, Gary Reno, in general about the role of immigration and how all these candidates are positioning themselves here in New Hampshire?
Well, I mean, with so many candidates, it's really hard. You really have to work very hard to make yourself stand out. And that's what we're seeing here, particularly on this immigration issue. And you know, they can all thank Donald Trump for, you know, sticking both feet in his mouth when he did. Otherwise, it wouldn't be such an issue that you could just grab onto like all these people are. And it's really dividing almost these candidates into two camps. I mean, the ones that basically are saying we do need to have a good idea about how we're going to deal with this immigration issue, and the others that are kind of this knee-jerk reaction about how we really do need to keep this in mind and make sure that we have a secure border and that we don't have all sorts of immigration, and these people that are here need to find another way to become part of the system.
Dean?
Yeah, this is a somewhat separate topic, but just in thinking about the Republican field and my recent experience with some of these candidates, it's fascinating to me how quickly your political fortunes can turn. You know, I spoke with Bobby Jindal, and back in 2008, 2009, 2010, Bobby Jindal was on the tip of every Republican as kind of the young, up-and-coming politician, potential presidential candidate. He was only in his late 30s. He's had some difficult challenges in Louisiana, and he finds himself in a very different position now than he was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And the same is true for Chris Christie. In 2012, Republican political elites were begging for Christie to run for president, and now he's trying hard to regain traction, and he's in the single digits in a lot of polls. So this is, for me, having seen these candidates several years ago, when they both Jindal and Christie, when they were sort of the kind of the hot newcomer politicians, and now they're both struggling to kind of find any traction at all, just shows you how quickly political fortunes shift.
Well, and what's that old saying, Dean? 6 months is an eternity in politics, or maybe it's 6 weeks.
Right.
I'm not
it
sure.
It is about right.
Again, it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup here in The Exchange. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. As we talk about some of the presidential candidates who've been in New Hampshire this past week, and there were a lot, which candidates were you interested in seeing? Did you catch any of these presidential visits? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, a couple candidates that haven't been in New Hampshire much made up for that this week, spending a lot of time in the Granite State. We mentioned Bobby Jindal. Another one is Ben Carson. He had some extensive visits here in the Granite State this week. Let's hear from former neurosurgeon and Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson. This is him speaking on tax policy at the famous Politics and Eggs event in Bedford.
And then the other thing that is really cramping our style is the taxation system. It is an absurd taxation system, 80,000 pages of tax regulations. It's ridiculous. And, you know, what I've advocated is something very simple, very proportional. And I get my ideal from the Bible, I will admit. Seems like God's a pretty fair person. And, you know, he asked for a tithe. He didn't say, if your crops fail, don't give me any tithe. He didn't say, if you have a bumper crop, give me triple tithe. He wanted everything proportional. You make $10 billion, you pay a billion. You make $10, you pay one. And you get the same rights and privileges. What could be more fair than that?
Again, that's Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson speaking at the Politics and Eggs event in Bedford this week. And Dean Spiliotis, you spent some time with Dr. Carson. What sort of crowd was following Dr. Carson at the event
to? Yeah, well, as you heard in that sound clip, he resonates very strongly with social and religious conservatives. He is a very kind of inspirational, kind of motivational figure. He's this groundbreaking African-American neurosurgeon. I believe he's the first neurosurgeon to separate conjoined twins at the head, who are conjoined at the head, which is sort of a remarkable thing in itself. But as you heard in that clip, I mean, he really is kind of running on his personal biography. He's written a number of bestsellers about different topics. There were lots. I do these interviews in public right here on Main Street in Concord, and he had the biggest crowd of the three that I interviewed this week. Lots of them had copies of his books to sign and pose for pictures. So there is. I mean, he is filling sort of that same niche as kind of a Mike Huckabee or Rick Santorum, or one of the other candidates who are kind of focused on social religious conservatives, evangelicals, et cetera. But, you know, the biggest problem for him, and I asked him about this, is, you know, we typically do not and have not in many, many, many years elected presidents who have absolutely no experience in any form of elected office at all. And, you know, the typical argument for someone like that is, well, you know, I'm not a politician. That's a refreshing thing. But it just – and the same is true for Carly Fiorina, although she's had more kind of, you know, business and public sector experience. It's just difficult. You know, saying that you're on a nonprofit board or a corporate board, it's not the same thing as being a chief executive. And so he struggled with that a little bit, and he didn't have a lot to say about policy, but the people who were there were sort of clearly inspired by him.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. Well, Democrat Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, spent time in New Hampshire this week, again in Concord, trying to boost his name recognition in a field with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, both of whom who are well known in the Granite State. Rick Stevens, did you cover former Governor O'Malley?
The AP did cover. We wrote about his white paper on education, higher education reform. What I found is interesting, if we can switch to the Democratic side for a little bit, although it applies to the Republicans too, is how they've identified their I think they refer to them sometimes as firewall states, but the states that they really have to do well at. And so Martin O'Malley, you're right, he hasn't been able to get very much traction yet against the much better known Hillary Clinton and the really popular insurging Bernie Sanders. He's had running that really fun populist campaign. So O'Malley, the former Maryland governor, comes out with an issue in New Hampshire that plays pretty well, education, higher education funding. You know, he puts out the ways to cut costs, including state spending more. Right now, New Hampshire, I think we still spend the least per capita. At one time, we spent the least per capita on higher education in terms of state aid. So O'Malley sees this as a way to sort of spark things in his favor in a key early state like New Hampshire, which, if you can get that early momentum in a primary season, can pay off.
Well, didn't he have some, what was it called, not free college, but no student debt or something like that? That was one of his pitches that he made this week.
He had that also, and Bernie Sanders had that too.
Yeah. O'Malley free, as well. Yeah. Okay. Well, again, Martin O'Malley spending a lot of time in the Granite State this week, along with others that we've talked about, Ben Carson, Bobby Jindal, Carly Fiorina. Let's hear a little bit of Martin O'Malley. This is him speaking with NHPR's Morning Edition producer, Michael Brindley.
I'm running for president of the United States, and I have 15 years of executive experience getting things done. I have to offer progressive values as well as an ability to actually deliver on the goals set, whether it's affordable college, reducing violent crime, increasing job creation, or defending the highest median income in the country through a recession. These are the things that I have to offer. And I'm looking forward to a robust debate with all of those who feel they have something to offer.
So again, that's Martin O'Malley. And Gary Reno, I don't know if there were other candidates that caught your attention this week. I know you've been busy at the State House on the budget, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I don't want to leave you out of this presidential conversation.
No, I think it's really starting to heat up here in the summer. And we've been people are here not just for a day or two. They're here for 3 or 4 days. And it's getting to be really interesting. I mean, it's early, traditionally early for this kind of inundation from the candidates. But again, there's so many of them on the Republican side, and they're starting. I mean, there are enough of them on the Democratic side too, and it's a very fascinating time. The problem with coming to New Hampshire this time of year, though, is you can walk in like the Tittle Diner and shake hands, but half of them are probably from Massachusetts. So you kind of have a hard time targeting New Hampshire voters.
You know, I've heard that. That's a really good point. And you see some of these stories.
As an aside to that, I've actually heard Democratic political elites saying that Hillary Clinton should not Hillary Clinton was a Republican. You shouldn't march in a Wolfboro – I think it was a Republican candidate. You shouldn't march in a Wolfboro parade because there are a lot of tourists up there. You're not going to meet New Hampshire. You got to go to Merrimack or Amherst to march. And so that's the level at which the strategy is being discussed.
Well, our fellow news colleague Paul Steinhauser is calling in from NH1 News. And Paul, thanks for being with us. I know you have been covering a lot of these people. We saw your interview with Bobby Jindal. Who else is catching your attention there at NH1?
I think the person besides Trump who's making the biggest headlines just in the last couple of days is Jeb Bush. Now, he picked a place actually that didn't have tourists. He was 2 days ago went to Dover, to Harvey's Bakery. Not a lot of tourists in downtown Dover on the summer midweek. And he stepped in a little bit with me. I asked him about Martin O'Malley's college-free debt for all Americans plan, which was coming out later that morning. And Jeb Bush said, well, to me it sounds like a lot of free things. And as you can imagine, Democrats immediately pounced on that. And then more a little later in the day, he stepped in it again a little bit bigger with the union leader when he talked about Americans need to be working longer hours. Now, he was saying that his comments were taken way out of context, that he was talking about Americans who aren't working a full 40-hour week right now. But a mixed week for Jeb Bush, Laura. He had some huge campaign finance fundraising numbers, both for himself and for his PAC. But at the same time, he stepped in a little bit here with these two comments. Just goes to show when you're the front runner or the perceived front runner like Jeb, everything you say is under the microscope.
All right. Paul, I got to cut you off. We're heading into a break. Thank you very much for joining us. Good to hear from you.
Love you guys.
All right. Bye-bye. That's Paul Steinhauser, NH1 News. More in a moment. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking about some of the top news stories of the week, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments as we go through the many, many stories that happened in the Granite State this week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And we turn now, gentlemen, to a story that caught our attention here at NHPR and that Morning Edition producer Michael Brindley covered, reflecting cultural shifts at Manchester's Police Department. Michael, you reported this week about Manchester Police Department's changing tattoo policy. Now, Michael, thank you for being with us. First of all, what was the policy regarding tattoos up till now?
The policy before was actually what's pretty common is that just essentially no visible tattoos. If you put a short sleeve shirt on you, which you would be wearing in the summer, and we can see any tattoo at all, no matter if it's offensive or not, you couldn't apply. So basically it's a pretty strict no visible tattoo policy that was enacted, I think, about 2 years ago in Manchester.
So you couldn't even apply. Don't bother.
Right, exactly. Essentially, you read the application, you go to the website, it says no visible tattoos whatsoever. You can't apply.
And how does that work? That's the case with most police departments then, and the state police, I understand. Michael,
yeah,
right?
I checked around a little bit. It's pretty common. Nashua, Concord, the state police all basically say to applicants looking online, you know, visible tattoos are a no-no.
So why the change in Manchester?
Well, Nick Willard is the new chief. He just actually got sworn in, I think, a week ago, maybe a little more than that. But he didn't waste any time. This is something that's been on his mind. It was sparked by an op-ed written by the wife of a veteran in Manchester who was frustrated that he came home. He wanted to be a police officer, and he has a military tattoo that says Army on his forearm. And he basically was trying to look at all these places, and they all said, sorry, you can't apply. So she was saying he served overseas, he did his duty, and he comes home and he can't do what he wants to do. So she was frustrated by that. He saw the op-ed, and he responded, and he said, this is something we should change.
Well, let's hear from Chief Willard himself in your interview with him, Michael.
What struck me is I had a military veteran come over to me who was being asked to leave the process, and he had an incredibly detailed memorial tattoo in honor of his best friend who was killed in action while the two of them served together in Iraq. And he said, just give me an opportunity, Chief. I will remove this tattoo. And I thought, you know, here a military veteran is who has something that means a great deal to him tattooed on his body that he wants to get rid of just for an opportunity to be a Manchester police officer. That struck a chord with me.
Again, that's Manchester's new police chief, Nick Willard, talking about a change in policies regarding tattoos for police officer recruits. Michael Brindley covered this story. Just a couple more questions for you, Michael. First of all, how's the department going to assess tattoos from here on out?
Right. So basically, this doesn't mean they're going to hire you necessarily. This means that you can apply. You can go through the physical training process or all of the different, you know, steps. And once you get to the background check phase, that's when they would say, okay, let's take a look at your tattoos and let's assess whether these are, you know, professional enough for the Manchester Police Department. Something we'd want you out on in the field representing the department. If the people could see them, it will be okay. So they're going to, you know, assess, it's a case-by-case basis. It's saying they're going to open the door, but we'll take it as a case-by-case basis and determine whether each tattoo is, you know, okay by our standards.
Wow. So if there were, you know, if a tattoo was perceived as sexist or racist or violent, they would have a problem with
it. Or even abundance of tattoos. The chief mentioned in his interview, you know, if you've got two full sleeves on your arms, that may not fit our level of decorum. So they're just saying we're opening the door. You know, obviously anything gang-related or, you know, racist would be a kind of a non-starter. So they're just saying, because he said himself that, you know, we found this was really excluding a lot of military veterans who, this is kind of a rite of passage for them, is to maybe get a tattoo memorializing somebody who was killed or their service. And so he's just saying, let's open the door a little bit and just do a case-by-case analysis.
One of the interesting things I thought from your interview, Michael, was the way Chief Willard sort of recognized cultural attitudes that differ among the generations regarding tattoos. And, you know, some younger people may think, what the heck? Why shouldn't police officers have tattoos? But Chief Willard said, you know, we're dealing with the broad public here and people have different feelings about this.
Right. And he said that's really the big balance with this kind of policy shift is you got the old guard and the new guard, and the old generation may say, this is seems unacceptable. How could we have people with visible tattoos walking around the streets, you know? And so it's really a generational thing. And I think he brings in maybe a little bit of a younger, fresher perspective. I believe he is a veteran as well, so he has that background as well. So it's something that was on his mind, and like I said, he didn't waste any time in jumping in and changing the policy.
Okay. Michael Brindley, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
No problem.
Rick, did you want to jump in there too?
I just thought it was interesting that as Chief Willard in Manchester sort of goes toward being more open-minded toward tattoos, the Army, and he makes his decision based on veterans and folks who've served, and the Army is reviewing its tattoo policy to get rid of them below the short sleeves, to restrict what their own soldiers, active duty soldiers, can have. So there's sort of a push-pull in the tattoo world right now.
Well, no surprise. We got lots of commentary again on Facebook around this. Susan says, my father had a small tattoo on his right wrist and was allowed to become a Lewiston police officer way back in the 50s. Susan says, I do think that tattoos in today's society are often inappropriate and, quite frankly, tend to diminish the image of a police officer as the law-abiding authority he or she must be. So there's Susan. Thank you, Susan, for that. Steve says, in this day and age, if you judge people in ink, you are clearly defined as an ignorant. New Hampshire has a larger amount of tattoo shops than most of New England. Some of the best artists in the country work in shops in Concord and Portsmouth. So lots of commentary on Facebook on that story. Gentlemen, we do need to turn to the state budget. And Gary Rayner, I'm going to kick that off with you. There's not a lot going on at the State House regarding this, but there's some things going on.
There's a lot of sniping going on, that's for sure. They're going back and forth. It's your fault. No, it's your fault. And we've had a list of press releases coming out this week that turning to take the other side into task and saying, well, you're the reason that we don't have the more drug treatment, you're the part of the problem. And it's been kind of entertaining if it weren't quite so serious.
Well, and one of the things that Democrats were upset about Dean Spiliotis is Speaker Sean Jasper, about a week ago, maybe a little more, suggested that Governor Hassan free Democrats to vote in favor of overriding her budget veto. Just help us untangle that,
Dean. He sent a letter to her on July 2nd, essentially a public letter, saying that and this is one of the oldest political ploys in the book. Leader of one party suggesting that if only the leader of the other party released his or her legislators that there would be enough votes to either override or pass a piece of legislation. So that's what he essentially said. You know, Governor Hassan, if you please allow the 160 Democrats in the House and the 10 Democrats in the Senate to vote their conscience, and what we'll end up with is an override of the budget. And Steve Shurtleff, the Democratic minority leader in the House, said there's no pressure being applied. Some other Democrats said they were insulted by the letter. It feeds into what Gary was saying about kind of the back and forth sniping. In the letter, Jasper did say that he thought there could be a compromise on Medicaid expansion and on the state employee contracts, but he said the tax cuts, which was one of Maggie Hassan's biggest objections, are off the table. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen? Everybody says, you know, everybody attacks each other, but then says, oh, and the door is always open to discuss. We may not really see anything until September or October, but this, you know, let your colleagues vote their conscience tactic has been around forever.
You've seen that one before.
And many times, both the state level and certainly in Congress.
Yeah, Gary, and then Rick. Go ahead, Gary.
It's interesting you say that because there wasn't a Democratic vote for the budget in either the House or the Senate.
Not one.
So,
wow.
I mean, it's a tall order to say that these people are going to jump ship and vote to override the budget. But what House Speaker Sean Jasper said in one of these letters was kind of interesting in that he was also talking about these business tax cuts, which had been such a huge issue for the governor. And he was saying that, you know, I don't believe that this is going to mean any more revenue for the state down the road, which is contradictory to what a lot of the senators were saying when they were trying to pitch these. And so the Democratic Party immediately jumped on this and said, well, he agrees with Hassan that it's going to be blowing a $90 million hole in the budget. Well, I mean, that's not what he said at all, but this is the sort of thing that's been going on this week. It's been kind of a little bit of playground going on, if you want to say that. But
Rick, do you want to jump in?
I'm struck by the difference this time around compared to 2 years ago. And for two straight years, the governor and members of the legislature said, we worked together. We reached across the aisle. We came up with this bipartisan budget. And this year, boy, it's anything but that spirit of cooperation.
Yeah, well, and while we're in this stalemate, Gary, just, you know, the reality on the ground is serious for some of these state agencies and state programs. And
particularly, I mean, with what we were talking about earlier, the mental health issue, I mean, that's a real problem. Some of the drug and substance abuse treatments, those, where there's more money put into those can't get off the ground. There are a whole bunch of things like that that are just sort of sitting there and waiting for additional funding to come in, and it's not there because we're stuck with the same funding we had this past year. But just to add, we did have a bipartisan budget that the governor signed this week, which was the capital budget.
Right, and you covered that. Just very quickly, tell us what the difference is between a regular budget and a capital budget and why the capital budget was so easy to pass.
The capital budget is like the investment in infrastructure and buildings and things like that. The two big issues, two of the big things in there is money for the women's prison in Concord and a new Merrimack County courthouse. What wasn't in there and which Hassan wanted dearly was $4 million for an environmental study for the rail, passenger commuter rail in the southern part of the state, which would have generated $55 million in federal money. But she said she'd overlook that because of the other good things that were in the budget. So kind of a contrast to what's going on with the operating budget.
Well, and speaking of, again, widespread concern about substance abuse and a growing crisis here in New Hampshire, the governor did sign a bill this week, a so-called Good Samaritan law. Can anybody just explain how these relate to the whole drug issue? Rick, you want to go ahead? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So the Good Samaritan law that the governor signed, it allows someone to report an overdose of a drug without facing, in most cases, without facing a criminal sanction. So you can, if heroin's being used, one person overdoses, the other person can call the police or a first responder to come. They hopefully, you know, revive this person, and there's no criminal charge. Again, in most cases, and there are protections in law if a person has a, you know, a deep past about for drug dealing or other violent crimes, there can be some criminal liability. New Hampshire joins, I think the last count was 22 states around the country plus the District of Columbia that have these Good Samaritan laws. They see it as a way to help you know, reduce overdose deaths. But the flip side of the coin from the opponent's perspective is that it can lead to a false sense of security, the way some of these other efforts that the states have taken. You know, oh, well, I can just call. Don't worry. If you overdose, I'll just call the cops and they'll come and everything will be
fine. They'll come with their Narcan. And,
right. So could it actually have a backlash effect? The same with the administration of Narcan, which I believe the governor this session also expanded the use of that, the distribution of that to allow more first responders and police and I think even family members to issue or to possess Narcan, which is this heroin, I'll use the word antidote. It's not exactly the accurate word. But so, again, all part of the states, and I say states plural, their efforts to fight this rising heroin and opiate abuse problem, which you see everywhere.
Yeah, it's just terrifying. And I'm hearing more and more and more about it week by week. So go ahead, Gary Reno, on this Good Samaritan angle of this, and then we've got some Facebook commentary that also raises some interesting points. I mean,
this bill has been around for probably 4 or 5 years, and it's never passed because of opposition to the law enforcement from law enforcement. And so this version of it has been narrowed considerably from what it was originally proposed. And because of the narrowing of it and frankly the heroin epidemic that we're experiencing in the state, is the reason that she basically said this is, I'll sign it, because in the past she hasn't always been a big supporter of it.
So law enforcement's concern, again, has been what? Rick touched on it, but just...
But that you're letting a lot of these people who are dealers and whatever go if you let these just have a, you know, they have an immunity from criminal prosecution.
Well, here's a Facebook comment from Jacqueline who says, the Good Samaritan Law is a poor measure of the state's effort to address the ongoing drug abuse problem. Jacqueline says, I think this is a way to skirt around doing the right thing and putting money where her mouth is and funding the sorely needed long-term facilities and programs addicts need. Jacqueline says this isn't even a Band-Aid, simply throws the ball off to the addicts to self-regulate. All this does, she says, is save dealers from paying for their crimes. And then a couple people think this is a good idea. Nick says yes, and this failure of a war on drugs. Treatment is the answer, not incarceration. Nell also says yes, education and rehabilitation. Gail says kind of what Jacqueline says. I think this bill would be better supplemented with funds for serious long-term treatment facilities. I don't want to see a life wasted for fear of prosecution, but without the ongoing support needed, I worry that it's not going to be as effective as a standalone. So thank you all for those comments on this issue. And just to wrap up very quickly with you gentlemen, Dean Spiliotis, a special election for a House seat on the Seacoast. These always draw a little bit of interest. Rio Tilton, 19 years old, won a special election in a big way, receiving more than twice the votes his opponents received.
Yes, this was a special election to replace Republican Dennis Sweeney, who was resigning for work schedule related issues in April, said he had work constraints, District 20, Seabrook and Hampton Falls. And you had this matchup of a 19-year-old Republican candidate, Rio Tilton, versus a 64-year-old former state rep, Elaine Andrews Ahern. And he won 772 to 375.
It's a big margin.
Yeah, yeah. And the controversy around this was that I believe it was NH1 did a story where they showed a lot of screenshots and screen grabs of social media in which Mr. Tilton appears to be smoking marijuana. And there were a lot of other screenshots of texting conversations that were very sort of juvenile in their behavior and sort of not what you would expect from somebody who's going to be a state representative. Nonetheless, he won pretty easily. He's replacing another Republican, so I guess that's not all that surprising. But we'll see how he comports himself. He has kind of said he's learned his lesson, et cetera, et cetera. I read the stuff. It's pretty juvenile. I mean, the marijuana use is a separate issue. We'll see. You know, when we got 400 people in the House of Representatives, all kinds of interesting people get elected, and you often sort of find out about the behavior at different points in their career. So we'll see how he does. But it was a pretty easy. Special elections are they often come at odd times, and we're in the middle of the summer, so. But he did well.
There you go. Well, and I want to let everybody know next week on The Exchange, the governor's coming in on Monday to give her side of the budget saga that we just talked about. And we talked with state lawmakers about it last week. So listeners, again, if you want to email us your questions for the governor before the show at exchange@nhpr.org. If you can't call in Monday morning, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org.
Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So we're busy with that. Rick Stevens, what are you covering next week?
We're going to look at some of the quirkier notions of the New Hampshire primary over the last 100 years.
Notions?
So, notions. Quirky notions. That's all I'm just going to tease you with that.
Okay, we'll wait for that. Gary, how about you?
Well, I'll be following the budget. And we're also having a lot of bills coming through that the governor is going to have to sign, veto, or whatever, including a voting rights bill, which probably will be vetoed today or maybe Monday or something like
that. Right, because in addition to the budget standoff, there's still all sorts of bills coming through the pipeline.
Yep.
Okay, how about you, Dean?
At least a half dozen candidates are going to be here this week. I'm particularly interested in Ohio Governor John Kasich, who's going to jump into the race on, I think, the Tuesday the 21st. Donald Trump's going to be back, always interesting. And Scott Walker, who we haven't seen in a while, he's been kind of tied up with Wisconsin budget politics like we have here. You know, he's sort of one of the front runners, but we haven't seen him in a while.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much for being here.
Sure. Thank you.
Great to be here, Laura.
It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.